Well, good morning. It's 10 a.m. here on the East Coast, and welcome to Your Turn. I'm Mike Causey. I'm glad to have you with us as we're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. And tell a friend about it. And also remember, our shows are archived on our homepage, so you can listen to this one or any previous show by clicking on the proper buttons. And I hope you do it, because we try to vary the guests and have some interesting people and tend to follow the money. That's sort of our goal in life. And two interesting guests today. Steve Losey from the Federal Times is going to be coming on later in the show to talk about a variety of things, including furloughs and the latest things that are being visited upon federal workers and retirees. And first out of the gate is Jessica Clement from the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association. Jessica, are you there?
I'm here. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you very much. I know you had to juggle a lot of things, and I know Wednesday is a particularly busy day for you, so thank you for shifting meetings, and thanks to those who let you shift the meetings. Jessica, what's your
title? Happy to do it for you,
good.
Mike, anytime.
Good. What's your title over at NARF?
Legislative Director.
Okay, so and NARF is one of the largest federal employee groups around, and has one of the largest PACs, and they've done marvelous work with Alzheimer's relief, and people are grateful for that. And before I forget, we got an email. Mark Harris in South Florida wants to bid you hello, and he's listening and says hello to you. So.
Hi to Mark as well.
Okay, and we've got a lot of fans out there. Number of things we wanted to cover, but and I appreciate your help yesterday with today's column, because I had a number of things that I didn't understand about this self plus one thing. And the idea of self plus one, it seems easy when you think about it, but currently, and correct me if I'm wrong, under the Federal Employee Health Program, you have two categories of people. You have self only, that would be me alone or you alone. Or you have family, and that could be a married couple. It could be a couple with 15 children. They could have 25 children. So you have a family and a self only. And the people in the family plans, regardless of how many children they have, up to and including none, pay the same basic premium as people who have lots of kids. And many people think that's unfair.
That's the gist of it. You, within FEHBP, just the health portion of it, your options are self or self plus family. Within the vision and dental, that self plus one option is available to participants.
Well, I know for years, people, and again, we're talking about the dinks here, you double income, no kids, couples, they argued that since they didn't have children, they shouldn't have to pay the same basic premium as people who have lots of children. And the Office of Personnel Management wouldn't entertain it as an option, because at the time they said it was cost prohibitive. So what's changed?
Well, I don't think it was so much cost prohibitive as that it didn't change the cost at all. So really, what was the point of undergoing, you know, the process if it's not going to change the cost? And it appears, since OPM originally came out with that standpoint, that they've done a little bit more research, and it looks like the self plus one option does in fact save a good chunk of money.
That's really funny, though, because for years it was somehow thought that it would impact the risk pool.
Well, the risk pool is the same no matter what. It's every, you know, it's every participant in FEHBP. So that really doesn't impact the premiums all that much.
Got a question from Josephine here, and she says, she's calling about phased retirement. The phased retirement option that was approved about a year ago, signed into law, and the OPM is still working on it. Can you kind of bring us up to speed on that phased retirement?
I can, although I don't have much to add to what you just said. Mm-hmm. The law was passed in July of last year, allowing employees to transition to part-time work while also collecting a partial annuity. OPM has not completed the regulations on this. Once the regulations are put out, I believe there's a comment period before implementation. So once those regulations come out, we should see that option available shortly thereafter, but the regs have got to come out first.
Well, director or former director John Berry, the Office of Personnel Management, said late last year that he hoped they would be out by early 2013, and we're already in the middle of 2013. What kind of problems does something like this? I mean, it sounds straightforward. I go to my agency. I say I want to I want to retire. I want to get in this phase program. I'd like to work 3 days a week for 6 months, and I guarantee that I will spend X amount of my time mentoring my replacement or some other people. What's the hang up?
It's just that they have to get the regulations written. This can't be implemented and can't be an option under the law until specific regulations are published by OPM. So that's your hang up.
Yeah, okay. Well, I guess it's
not the agencies. It's not, it's not that they can't move forward with this until the regulations are written.
Well, this is typical, too. Congress passes a law saying, let's eliminate poverty, and then they hand it over to a federal agency to say, by the way, tell us how we're going to do this.
And they cut their funding under sequestration, and they furlough their employees, and they still want it to get done in a timely manner.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. OPM has ducked that so far, but I know they had to eliminate overtime for those people who were processing the backlog in retirement claims, and that's a blow.
It is going to be a blow. It's going to be interesting to see what that does. They've made a lot of progress in bringing down the retirement backlog. NARF testified before the House on this issue a few weeks ago. They've made incredible progress, and that is all threatened right now.
Well, we had a number of emails this morning because of the column, and I said you were going to be on, said we were going to talk about phased retirement, and it had a half a dozen people who wanted a progress update, but all of them said, I am literally waiting for this to be implemented. The day it's in place, I'm out the door. I'm gone.
I wish I had more information for them.
Yeah.
For your listeners on that end, but unfortunately, we're just waiting on OPM to move on the regulations.
Yeah, this is one you may not be familiar with this, but this is from Sherry, and she says it's interesting that there's little information on part-time federal employees FEHBP changes in January 2014. She said that in May, benefits officers had a working group in which agencies were informed they were looking at changing eligibility due to Obamacare changes due in 2014. OPM stated they'd address the issue in the fall, and they're working on the issue. Do you or any of your guests have any insight into the FEHB part-time employee options and costs?
At this point in time, I ran your question by someone in my office who knows these issues a little bit better than I do.
Right.
To the best of our knowledge, there were no changes to how healthcare is, the premiums are determined for part-time employees as it relates to the Affordable Care Act.
Okay. All right. Yeah, always too soon for that. Another question here from Michael, and this is how will this new option, talking about the self plus one, affect employee FEHBP premiums? Presumably, and I'm guessing, people with self plus one would pay a lower premium than people with a family of more than two?
On the face of it, presumably that will probably be the case. Of course, it will be specific to the individual plans and how they determine, what the costs are for the three options. So it could vary from plan to plan. It is quite possible that self plus one could be more expensive under a certain plan if that group, say, had a higher proportion of retirees that were not covered by Medicare. Part B, most retirees, as it relates to FEHBP, are covered by Medicare Part B, which is why the self plus one option actually saves money for the government.
Okay.
So, it's going to be left up to the individual plans. The percentage that the government pays compared to the percentage that the employees pay under the proposals laid out by OPM and the administration, that wouldn't change. So it would still be, on average, 72% of the premiums would be paid by the government.
And so you have, if employees have Social Security coverage once they're retired, the FEHBP, Social Security becomes the primary payer, is that right?
Medicare.
Right.
Yes,
all right.
Please.
Jessica Clement, National Active and Retired Federal Employees, take a short break here on Federal News Radio. We'll be right back here on 1500 AM, federalnewsradio.com. Mike Causey, welcome back to your turn. I'm talking with Jessica Clement. She is Legislative Director of the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association. And, Jessica, the big emphasis on the active, because NARF has made a big push in the last half dozen years or so to recruit people who are still working for the government. You don't have to be retired to join NARF.
You do not have to be retired to join NARF. Our dues are actually very low, and, we'd encourage your listeners to come join us.
Your annual dues are about half of my biweekly dues. So, a good deal, trust me. Here's one. We've covered this, but I wanted to get on it because he took the time to send us an email. It's from Richard T. Wagner. He's retired defense civilian, and he's a NARF member. He says Indiana Chapter 0813. And he said that last year, November of 2012, he sent me a letter about this, or an email asking about the possibility of a single plus one, and that I checked it out and said that it looked like it would be cost prohibitive at the time. And now you're saying that's not the case, that it will not cost money and it might even save money.
That is not what we're being told by OPM. Mm-hmm. CBO also has their own analysis that I believe says this also saves a little bit of money, but not as much as OPM says it does. This is the administration's proposal. It's important to keep in mind that this would require legislation. So the idea is out there, but it would have to move, through Congress before it ever became law. If the cost did shift, say, this brings down the cost for the self plus one folks, but then raises the cost for self plus family, there would obviously be, a net neutral effect. This wouldn't save any money, in terms of deficit.
Right, unless you're on the receiving end of it. Yeah, it is interesting that the administrations have either ignored this or opposed it in the past, often on cost grounds, and now they're saying it would be we're for it because it would be either revenue neutral or maybe even save some money. So
right. One of the things to keep in mind, of course, when it comes to the FEHBP, that one of its central tenets is choice. If this were to be implemented and you were unhappy with then the premiums you'd be paying as self plus one under your current plan, you always have the option of switching to a different plan.
Yeah, that's true. And the thing for people to remember, was a number of the emails we got are from people who want to know what's the best plan under Obamacare. And, of course, we don't know that. But what you want, if you want the basic coverage, you want good catastrophic coverage, that's the reason people buy health insurance, even if they don't know it. Medical bills are the number one cause of bankruptcy in this country. If you're in the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program, virtually any plan, there's a stop loss figure for each of those plans, and I think the maximum is something like $16,000 would be the maximum out of pocket to you, and that could be a lifesaver and a finance saver. So what you want to do is, Obamacare or not, is you want to get a good basic plan with a good catastrophic coverage, and you want one that your doctors are in that plan.
Yes. I mean, it's a very personal decision. It's very individual. You have the option of choosing the plan that works best for you. More often than not, when open season comes around, very, very few people change their plan. But that option does exist for you. And if your current plan isn't working, then research some others. I believe there are 13 national plans on top of the, the state-specific plans.
I think NARF ought to consider setting up a Jessica Clement Crystal Ball Award. I was thinking about this when I was writing the piece today. But a couple of years ago, you and I were at the FDR conference in Palm Desert or Palm Springs, one of those great places to be, even though it was August. And somebody, I think Bill Bransford of Shaw Bransford, came in with a newspaper. And it was the USA Today and a front page story. And I believe it said federal workers are paid more than people in the private sector, something like that. We all looked at it. And I thought, well, it's a one-day wonder. And you said, this is going to be trouble. This is a problem. And indeed, the story did have legs. It has been running in one form or another all over the country in various newspapers, various forms, that federal workers are overpaid, that they can't be fired, that they're paid more than their counterparts in the private sector. But any way you slice it, the government is the best deal. And the only thing that seems to have interrupted that flow of anti-Fed stories has been sequestration and the distractions we have now with some of the other scandals du jour. But so you were 100% right there. You hit that one out of the park. And last year on this very radio show, we were talking about threats, and I mentioned that most of the people I was hearing from were concerned that the high three retirement formula would be changed to a high five, and that seemed to be the fixation for most people. And you said that's not it's not even in the ballpark. You said that the great dangers are twofold. One is the chained CPI, which a lot of people had not even heard of at that time, and the possibility of introducing a voucher system into the federal health system. Well, now we have the chained CPI is upon us. It was in the president's budget, correct?
It was.
And can you explain how that works? Because it sounds like a bad soap opera.
Yeah, we get a lot of questions from this, too. You know, everyone assumes you know that we know what chain CPI is. You need to take a step back. So let me do the best I can.
Mm-hmm.
So the current formula used to calculate the COLA is called the CPIW. It measures the spending habits of urban wage earners under the age of 62. The chain CPI formula would use a similar formula to what we're using now, but it assumes behavioral changes, such as when the price of goods rise, you change your buying habits. You buy chicken instead of steak. You buy canned tuna instead of chicken. You know, that behavioral changes are not taken into account with the current formula. Therefore, inflation is, in fact, lower because you're modifying your behavior to account for the rise in goods. So basically what the chain CPI does is take that behavior modification into account, leading to smaller COLAs every year. So for instance, I believe the Bureau of Labor Statistics has covered the chain CPI over the last 20 years, and the difference from year to year is about 0.3%. So the COLA this year for those who receive Social Security, military retirement, veterans disability insurance, and federal retirement annuities was 1.7%. Had the chain CPI been used to calculate COLAs this year, it would have been 1.4.
And that doesn't seem like a whole lot to an individual, but when you apply it to a group, that huge number of people, one in six people who get a Social Security check, the retired feds, the retired military, and the veterans benefits, it becomes billions of dollars very quickly.
Very, very quickly. Hundreds of billions of dollars.
Right, and some people have calculated that, I believe, over 5 years, if the chain CPI was in effect, that a retiree, instead of getting X amount, would be getting $1,500 less than that amount under the current system, and over a longer period of time, 15, 20 years, I think it works out to about $14,000 a year less in benefits that would have occurred under the CPIW.
I'm happy you bring that up because NARF has a handy calculator on its homepage that allows you to get a rough estimate. Of course, this is not, 100% accurate, mm-hmm. of what the chain CPI would mean for you. The average Social Security benefit in this country right now is $15,000 a year. We're not talking about people who are making a lot of money. No, these are people who are only making $15,000 a year to begin with. Over a 20-year period using the NARF calculator, that would mean you would lose almost $14,000 in benefits over those 20 years. That's an inflation-adjusted figure. For CSRS employees, where the average pension is about $32,000, over a 20-year period, you're losing almost $30,000. And it's unfortunate, in particular, for the FERS employees, who not only would get hit with their FERS annuity and their Social Security annuity, but if the COLA is over 2%, FERS retirees don't even receive the full COLA. So now they get like a triple whammy with this.
Yeah, so that's compounding in reverse, isn't it? You're losing 0.3% on average each and every year. That's what you don't see, what you don't get.
Right. In the first year, it's not going to be a big deal. In the second year, probably mm-hmm. not either, even the fifth year. But you're talking people are living longer. It is not uncommon to live 25 years after you retire. That is a huge chunk of money.
Yeah, and it's the kind of thing that after a period of time, you probably literally wouldn't notice it. You'd miss it, but you wouldn't notice it. There was a picture in the Washington Post this morning showing a Bureau of Labor Statistics employee actually going through a supermarket with a counter and doing the prices. This is actually how it works. You have people all over the country gauging prices for various things. The thing that intrigues me about the CPI is that they talk about the chain CPI being more accurate because it reflects the fact that when things get expensive, people change their habits. If steak is overly expensive you get hamburger than you go to chicken or whatnot. But some people have carried this out to its extreme, and you finally go down to a cheap hamburger with Hamburger Helper, and then finally you get rid of the hamburger and have only the Hamburger Helper. I mean, you can see it going that way.
Exactly. And for seniors who are already living on a fixed income, as one NERF member pointed out to me, I'm not eating caviar and drinking fine wine.
Yeah.
I'm already changing my buying habits to buy the generic supermodic products, buy the cheaper goods. The other problem with the chain CPI is that it doesn't accurately reflect the health care costs of seniors, and neither does the current formula of the CPIW. Since it measures those in urban areas under the age of 62, it only accounts for about 5% of their income being spent on health care costs, whereas Americans over the age of 62 spend about 12% of their income on health care costs. So not only doesn't the current formula accurately reflect health care costs experienced by seniors, the chain CPI only exacerbates that problem.
Okay, well, this is one to watch, and you were right, as per usual. Thank you, Jessica Clement, for being with us. Going to take a short break here. When we come back, I'll be speaking with Stephen Losey from the Federal Times here on Federal News Radio, federalnewsradio.com. Welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Causey, and glad to have you with us. We're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Hope you tell a friend, and remember we are archived on our homepage so you can listen to this show or any previous shows at your leisure. I'm going to be talking with Stephen Losey. He is a senior writer for the Federal Times and a frequent guest here. Steve, are you with us?
I'm here. How are you
doing?
Hey,
thanks for standing by. Sounds like you are literally in the room here.
good
acoustics today. Steve, before I get rolling, I got some questions, but what are you working on? What's of interest?
Well, right now we're kind of keeping track of the whole furlough situation. As you know, last week we had it was sort of dubbed Furlough Friday. Mm-hmm. We had roughly 5% of the federal workforce was sent home without pay last Friday, as this was kind of the first major wave of furloughs that we've seen since sequestration went into effect. We had the IRS, EPA, Office of Management and Budget, and HUD shut down entirely to try to meet their mandated budget cuts. And there were a few other employees at Labor and the Park Police who went home last week as well, although those two agencies did not shut down entirely. So the long-awaited, long-dreaded furloughs are starting to kick into gear, and this is something that federal employees are learning to adjust to.
Well, you know, what strikes me about it is how uneven this sequestration is. You know, we were told at the beginning, everybody, the White House who invented it and the Congress who permitted it, happily permitted it to go into effect, but everybody said this is going to be so awful that we can't let it happen, and if it does happen, it won't last long. And yet, in fact, there were some delayed reactions to this or delayed actions to it. And the Pentagon, which appeared to be the agency that would lead the parade, said it was going to furlough virtually all of its 780,000 civilians for 22 days. Now it's down to 11 days and many, but not all of its employees.
Yeah, but it's something like 680,000.
Right, and they still haven't done it yet, correct?
Yeah, although the notices are, as we speak, just starting to go out. We've gotten some reports from DOD employees that said they got it their notices today or yesterday. So the ugly process is beginning that is going to result in virtually 20% pay cuts for about 11 weeks for federal employees.
What about defense contractors and contractors with places like EPA and HUD and IRS?
The furloughs don't affect contractors, and that is something that is really sticking in the craw of the unions and some of the employees who are being furloughed, who see this as something of a haves and have-nots kind of situation. They say some people, including the union, say if this is going to hit everybody, it should hit everybody, and why are these contractors exempt when I'm having to go home? And they say in some cases these contractors are paid considerably more than the people they work beside. So there's we could see some bad blood and some hurt feelings start to bubble up in the federal workplace, and this could create some conflict down the road if this persists. I mean, you know, if it's 5 days or so, you know, 1 year, and that's it. That's not great, of course, but that's one thing. But if we're talking weeks on end this year, and who knows what's going to happen next year, if it keeps happening and contractors keep dodging that bullet of furloughs, I think we could see some strife start to emerge in the federal workplace.
Well, and the other side of that is if a contractor works in a federal building and they shut it down for the day, as HUD did and as IRS did and EPA, then they can't get in. And the contractor won't pay them.
That is true. That is true. So I that's correct. In some cases, there may be contractors who are affected by this.
My oldest son was visiting in North Carolina last week. Loved it. Loved the people. But he said that when you drive into North Carolina, it's the border from Virginia to North Carolina, it says, welcome to the most military-friendly state in the Union. And, of course, you've got Camp Lejeune and Cherry Point and Fort Bragg and many, many installations there. I would think in places that are largely dependent on a federal operation, my favorite poster town for this is Ogden, Utah. You have a huge IRS operation out there, and you have Hill Air Force Base, and those are the primary employers for most of the people at Ogden. Now, if the IRS shuts down one day every 2 weeks, if the Defense Department, Hill Air Force Base, and the Dugway Proving Ground, if they shut down for one day a week and it has a ripple effect on the contractors and the communities, that could really start hurting, couldn't it?
That's correct. I mean, you're absolutely right. I lived in eastern North Carolina for several years, mm-hmm. and I know exactly how much many of those communities rely on the military bases and some of the federal offices that are there. These government organizations have been there for decades, since pretty much World War II. They've grown up. They've integrated themselves into the fabric of the community. And, you know, it's not just North Carolina, of course. You've got places like South Dakota. You got Texas. You got Oklahoma. You got Arkansas. These military bases that are just part of the community. And, of course, the military service members themselves are not being furloughed. That's true. But a lot of many of the civilian DOD employees who are necessary to make those organizations run are getting furloughed. And that bites in so many ways. You know, first off, you've got the commissaries on these bases that the service members and their families rely on. And those, I believe in some cases, are having to close down early or for certain days on days when there are furloughs. So the commissaries are taking a bite. That impacts the life of the military community. And the DOD civilian employees, they're, of course, having 20% less pay in their checks those weeks. So they have to cut back somewhere. So maybe that means they don't go out to a restaurant. Maybe that means they don't go to a movie. Maybe that means they cut back on their grocery bills. And some people might say, well, so what? You know, maybe these federal employees should be tightening their belts because we're tightening our belts too. But the problem is, you know, it doesn't just hurt those federal employees. It hurts the people who own those restaurants, who own those grocery stores, who are suddenly seeing less income. And there's kind of what I'm getting at is there's kind of a ripple effect. The economy is so interwoven that an impact that hurts a federal civilian employee naturally ripples out into the broader community, the local businesses.
Well, you know, in an area like Washington, we have been pretty much recession-proof in this area because of the government and because of the people who live off of the government, including people like us whose jobs are dependent on government, government service and reporting on it. But when you go out toward the Dulles Airport and you see those corridors, the defense contractors, and you go out 270 and you see the tech and the pharmaceuticals and whatnot that are government-based because the NIH is in Montgomery County. But I think a lot of people don't realize how important the government is in places like Virginia Beach and Norfolk and Hampton Roads and some of these smaller areas where it is the predominant employer, and it generates, you know, I think for every one federal job, there are six other jobs that are generated by it.
That's right. You know, the Norfolk area, the more southern parts of Virginia, I mean, the Navy is very big there, of course. There's shipyards, yeah. There's bases. So, yeah, there's a large – and, you know, a lot of those people who do the repair work and build the ships are civilian employees. So, yeah, there are definite impacts. And your point about the you know, Washington, D.C. metro area, yeah, having weathered the recession is true, of course. However, I'm kind of curious to see how well this area weathers this sequester impact, because obviously, yeah, the recession did more or less pass us by in many yeah. respects, but I believe we're about to see a delayed impact as the wave of stimulus spending the government enacted after the financial crash recedes, and as the sequester cuts and these furloughs start to kick in. There may be a kind of delayed aftershock that does encompass the Washington, D.C. area.
Yeah. And, well, we have about 14% of the federal population here, so, and that's the good news and the bad news. I'm going to take a short break here talking with Stephen Losey from the Federal Times. Be right back here on Federal News Radio, federalnewsradio.com. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey. I'm talking with Stephen Losey, senior writer with the Federal Times, and we were talking about the sequestration and furloughs, but the impact of government on so many communities around the country, and how it's even bigger in some places than it is here. Huntsville, Alabama has a huge federal presence considering its population. Again, Ogden, Utah, and a number of places like that. Steve, I've got a war story for you that it's absolutely true. I was there. Did the T-shirt. I had a friend, goes back about 15 years now. He was an officer on the George Washington. At the time, it was the largest aircraft carrier in our fleet. It's not anymore, but it was at the time. Had a crew, about 4,500 officers and men, I think. You know, its own newspaper, its own laundry, its own food services. You know, it's a floating city. And they got a request from a delegate from Puerto Rico and the government of Puerto Rico to come and visit them on a training cruise. Now, they had to do their training somewhere, but Puerto Rico said, please send them to us. And so they went from Norfolk to San Juan and were there a week. But the purpose of it, in addition to the training, was you got 4,500 men and women who were paid in cash. And they are there for a week, and that gave a shot in the economy of San Juan and the island of Puerto Rico, just that one visit.
Ah.
And imagine this going on all the time, all over the world, all over the country.
Yeah, and if those opportunities dry up, then, yeah, they do have an impact. I mean, those are dollars that aren't being spent in local economies, so... There seems to be sort of a belief in some quarters that, you know, the federal employees are just milking the taxpayer, not producing anything of value in return, and that's, you know, clearly false. But to paint the federal workforce in that way ignores the real effect it has on local communities, people who help provide veterans. For example, the VA. You got nurses and doctors at VAs throughout the country who are taking care of millions of current and former veterans and service members. You've got people who are not current, of course, but former service members. You've got IRS employees who are helping taxpayers sort out the problems with their taxes. You've got Social Security employees who are helping people who, you know, need help, you know, retirees who need help with their benefits. HUD people who are helping people find houses, citizens find houses. So there's a wide array of benefits that the federal government provides to the United States citizens through their employees. And if you start furloughing them, you start doing away with them, then the government's ability to provide those services that we pay for in our taxes and that we expect to be there when we need them goes away. and you know, not just the actual effect, but the spending power of those employees in the local communities.
Well, I've talked to a couple of IRS revenue agents, revenue officers, and whatnot, and they talk about how much money on average they bring in every day. And one gave me his salary, and he broke it down, and his pay was X amount for that day. But while he was working on that day, he brought in a huge amount. I think it was like 14 times his salary in bona fide justified revenue, and you know, multiply that across the IRS, and you know, people say, well, we'll make it up. They won't make it up. That day is gone with the wind forever.
Right. Those kinds of decisions end up being sort of penny wise, pound foolish. You cut that guy, for example, and you say, oh well, we just saved I don't know, $75,000 a year. Bully for us.
Yeah.
And then you lose $100 million in tax revenue that guy might have collected. Maybe not 100 million, but it's, call it $1 million in tax revenue that guy might have collected.
Yeah.
That doesn't add up to me. And that's a very narrow way of looking at things.
Well, so often, and you know this as well as I do with these political decisions, both parties do it. Everybody does it in Washington. You find out, you decide what you want to prove, and then you pack the numbers accordingly.
Exactly.
And not looking at the big picture. Gotten several emails here from six, in fact, from people all with the same theme, and maybe you could help out. They're ready to go. They're ready to retire, anxious to leave, but they are concerned about, A, the backlog at the Office of Personnel Management, the backlog in retirement applications, retirement claims, and they're also concerned about the delayed start for this phased retirement. Can you bring any information on either of those?
Yeah. Let's tackle the pension issue first. The Office of Personnel, this has been, of course, a problem that OPM has been struggling with for decades. They've had... For years, it's been widely known that it takes several months, sometimes, you know, in some cases, tragically, more than a year for federal employees who have just retired to get their full and complete pension. In the meantime, they have to get by on a partial pension that sometimes is considerably less than what they are owed. So OPM last January said, we're going to tackle this once and for all. Former Director John Barry unveiled a plan that included hiring more employees to process these claims, granting significantly more overtime, and an array of process improvements to tackle the issue. And it has been showing results. Since January 2012, the backlog has been cut in half, from roughly 61,000 to 30,000 claims. That's the good news. The bad news is, and this kind of ties in with all the sequester stuff we've been talking about, the sequester might drive a stake through the heart of these improvements. I mentioned before John Barry granting overtime. Well, guess what? That overtime is now gone because OPM can't afford to pay for these people to stay, you know, longer to process these claims. Now, and with the disappearance of that overtime, who knows what's going to happen to OPM's productivity? They've been very productive. They've, you know, since late 2012, they've been shooting past their goals, sometimes considerably. They've had, in some cases, some months, there's been unexpected spikes in the number of retirements, which, you know, some say in some months it may be a sign of the retirement wave. In some months, it's definitely a sign of a reflection of buyouts and early outs. But there's been swells in the number of retirements, and OPM's been able to more or less weather those swells. However, who knows what's going to happen now that overtime is gone? Next week, we're going to get the results of May, what happened in May. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens with that.
Right, and then you have people who say they're poised to leap as soon as this phased retirement is allowed to kick in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something that Congress approved last year. However, it's been kind of quiet on that front lately. Basically, what OPM wants to do is allow federal employees who are eligible to retire, but maybe want to have, you know, they don't want to just go completely into retirement. You know, John Barry used to joke, you can only play so much golf.
Yeah.
Some people, want to take a little bit more time to enjoy their golden years, but they still have some experience. They still have some projects they want to wrap up. They still want to mentor some younger people. They still want to pass on some of their knowledge. So the idea is you work, say, half-time, and you get half a pension. There could be some adjustments, could be quarter time, could be, you know, one fifth of a time or whatever. But for argument's sake, we'll just say you work half time.
Okay, we're gonna have to check out those main numbers and see where we're going here.
Yes.
So, all right, Steve, thank you so much for being with us. Hope to get you back here next week. Have a good week, everybody. We'll see you next Wednesday at 10 a.m.